Welcome to the Leeds Church Institute podcast. LCI is a faith-based organisation for lifelong learning. You can find out more about the Leeds Church Institute by visiting lcileeds.org.
Well, good evening and a very warm welcome indeed to Leeds Minster, particularly if you're here in this building for the first time. You're very warmly welcome indeed. It's a real joy to welcome Mark Oakley as the Hook Lecturer for 2019. My great predecessor, Dr. Walter Farquhar Hook, had a great vision of combining education and Christian presence in this great city. And through this lecture, we seek to bring together the Academy through our partnership with the Department of Theology and Religious Studies at the University of Leeds, as well as with the Minster and also the Leeds Church Institute, something that, because I'm Rector of Leeds, I have the privilege of being ex officio chair and president of. It's an organisation of which I'm really very proud. This series has gathered a momentum of its own over the years. We've had all kinds of illustrious speakers, and tonight is no exception. Some of you may know Mark from this book, The Splash of Words. It's worth it just for the introductory chapter, actually, on what poetry is all about, but the rest of it is a real treat as well, as Mark explores all kinds of different poems. And then on Monday, this book is being launched by way of the heart, which really summarises Mark's understanding of how poetry moves us and moves our intellect by way of the heart. And that's a collection of Mark's sermons. If you've ever had the misfortune to preach at St. Paul's Cathedral, you'll know it's a vast, cavernous pulpit. And one of the challenges there is crossing the distance between yourself and the congregation. A congregation who you don't know by name, have no idea why they're there, and probably won't ever come back again, not just because of the preacher. Mark has a wonderful ability to cross any kind of distance, and watching him at work in St. Paul's once or twice was seeing a master at work. Now Mark's moved on from being Canon Chancellor of St. Paul's to St. John's College, a much more intimate setting, though it's one of the bigger college chapels, and yet also a place where distance needs to be crossed because of people's positions in relationship to the Christian faith and perhaps also in relationship to the church. And that's where Mark's currently exercising his ministry of crossing distance and of embodying nearness as well. Nearness to God in his own life, and that ability of drawing near to others in order to help them approach and understand the mystery of the divine. Mark, it's really good to welcome you to Leeds and to have you as our lecturer for the Hook Lecture 2019. Would you join me in welcoming Mark?
Well, thank you very much indeed for that very kind welcome. I must say, it's wonderful to be in Leeds. I'm really delighted that you invited me, and very grateful for allowing me to speak to you this evening. Some of you will probably know the story of the very holy rabbi who went to the men's barbers for a haircut. At the end, he went to pay, but the barber wouldn't take his money. "No, Rabbi, I never take money from the clergy." And the following morning, when the barber got to work, there on the step of his shop was a very large bag of bagels. The next day, a Catholic priest went for his haircut. At the end, he went to pay. "No, Father," said the barber, "I never take money from the clergy." And the following morning, there on the steps was a very large bottle of whiskey. The following day, an Anglican priest went for a haircut. He went to pay, but the barber was clear. "No, Reverend, I never take money from the clergy." And the next day, there on his step was a very long queue of Anglican vicars. You'll see that there is a temptation in all of us, but particularly in some of us Anglican clergy, I think, to be easily in it for ourselves, a little bit too self-referential, self-preserving, self-righteous even. And what I've really been grateful about this invitation is for me to think a little about the world at the moment and the Christian place within it, who we are, who we should be, in times which frankly are very baffling and sometimes disturbing. And I've talked in my title about poets and prophets and protesters being a way forward. And that's what I hope to explore with you. I always, at this stage in the proceedings, take confidence in the comment of Quentin Crisp that if at first you don't succeed, failure may be your style. This is not a very good time for clairvoyance. We don't know what's going to happen from one hour to the next in our world at the moment. T.S. Eliot famously asked in The Rock, "Where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? Where is the knowledge we have lost in information?" And for me, and I guess for some of you, we have a desire at the moment to balance a fundamental belief in liberty, equality, and community. And not only that, but to do it alongside the recognition in our lives of faith, which is that sense of invitation by the transcendent to deepen relationships with the source and the expressions of love and life. And those two things should come together in my life because I know that both are important. Upholding liberty, equality, community. And not being apologetic about the glimpses of wisdom that I receive from my Christian faith. And I believe that both these things, the vision of liberty, equality, community, and the vision of Christian faith, are both deep resources for public life and shared living. I profoundly believe that. And so I want to argue that people of faith and, say, politicians, should have something very much in common. Because both, at the end of the day, should be people who are loyal to the future. Gladstone once said that we can't fight the future because time is on its side. Now, the church can spend a lot of energy trying to work out how it can be loyal to the past, and for some very good reasons. Ultimately, though, the church believes in a pilgrim God who leads us on, and it is to that God's future that, say, Christian hearts must be committed. As I said yesterday at the clergy conference in the Leeds Diocese, God loves us just as we are, but God loves us so much, he doesn't want us to stay like that. We have too many full stops that need changing into commas. And when Jesus preached about the kingdom, he was inviting us into that future. Likewise, Parliament, city halls, political debates are, at the end of the day, conversations in the present that are for the sake of the future. The difficulties lie in just what sort of future people want. I think it's clear to anyone committed to religious faith and to political visions that we always need to restore the political dimensions of the vision of faith. We don't want a faith that's just self-regarding, navel-gazing. So there is a political consequence to the vision of faith. I remember very early on Archbishop Michael Ramsay saying that as he looked around the world he was in, he just saw individualism increasing and increasing. He said, but actually Christianity never allowed that. It can't allow it. Individualism, it's so contrary to its vision. So there are dimensions of political action that come out of our Christian faith, and it's awful when that is not alive or perceptive. So you get this church that can be turned in on itself. I always think it's epitomised by those endless debates in General Synod about General Synod. That's a curdled response to vocation, it seems to me. Likewise, any political manifesto that tells us how we might have lots to live with, but then can't tell you what we might live for, is not taking the human seriously. It will be a flamboyant label on empty luggage, destined for nowhere. It will lead to, frankly, what we've seen in recent days, a political swimming pool with a lot of noise coming from the shallow end. To take politics seriously, you must take the whole human seriously, the human need to relate, to love, to learn, to be creative, to lose but build again, to respond to beauty, intimations of the divine even. The value of a religion is how much it allows you to see, not close off. Always judge religion by how much it's allowing you to see more. The belief of faith is that we have been given the gift of our being, and the gift we give back is our becoming. It's one of the summaries of the gospel for me. You've been given a gift, it's your being. Now give the gift back in your becoming, who you become, both as individuals but also as society, how we decide to become together. The value of politics is how much it will allow you and those you share the polis, the city, with to flourish in this way. How do we shape who we become for the common good, not just for my good? And there's so much to be shared and talked about here between people of faith and people of the political world, those who are trying to shape for the future. This is such a fertile area, and yet sometimes there's a lot of embarrassment going on about whether we can talk together about these things. But as I've been reading a lot of Gladstone recently, you're going to get a few quotes by Gladstone. He once said, "Nothing that is morally wrong can ever be politically right." And that's the area that I'm interested in at the moment. Nothing that is morally wrong can ever be politically right. Now, to talk about these things, as I've just said, in the public square, can be very hard at the moment. We don't have a shared or a natural language for the soul. We have many conflicting visions about what we want as our future, as a nation, as a planet. It's hard to find a language with which to make plausible and attractive those things that many of us thought were taken for granted. Things like liberal democracy, the rule of law, civil liberties, the protection of those seeking refuge and safety, minorities who suffer hate and so on, needing protection. Now, to find that language to make these things sound plausible and attractive, things that we once thought were just taken for granted, seems to me to be urgent. To find the words to appeal to upcoming generations about the things that matter to us is vital. We need a language that renews the sense of citizenship for which people are a part, a language unashamed to revitalize its values and show that they can be translated for everyone, and so on. And it does mean that we need political parties and those who work in governments, local and national, to learn how to be honest so that they can be heard as genuine and not part of a fake racket. And it's the same in the church, that can often speak a lot about truth but finds honesty much more difficult. But if some are now in our world campaigning in graffiti and then governing in tweets, then those committed to, say, liberty will need to have a much higher reverence for language and its relationship to truth. They must resist political conformity as regards current behaviour. There can be no abiding social contract, no trust, no lasting relationships or belief in human exchange, all those things that politics claims it wants, by the way, without basic trust in language as a vehicle for truth. And this is why I've brought the word poetry in my title tonight. Poets are the antennae of the world, people who allow words to become a fountain to draw trust and perception and hope from, not just words to make a noise so that the first one to draw breath is called the listener. Or, again, in Gladstone's words, the strength of your feeling is mistaken for the strength of your argument. Christians know that words indeed become flesh, and that when words are mistreated and not respected, as night follows day, human beings will also then become mistreated, scapegoated, ignored, or demonized. So honesty and respect for truth and for words that build us up and not simmer us down, that would be a very timely aspiration for us to be pursuing. And so, if I just think for a little bit, and some of you will have read The Splash of Words, maybe, but I want to just think for a moment about poetry, because we often think we know what we're talking about, but then perhaps realise we don't. A lot of people, of course, their memory of poetry is from school, and it gives a shiver down the spine, because it either bored you to death, or you had a very unpleasant teacher who had a go at you because you couldn't remember it, or you didn't understand it, and so on. But before I talk about poetry, I just want to revisit what I'm saying about the present climate, because I'm not just talking about poetry in terms of somebody writing a poem and that's going to save the world. No, I'm talking about poets as people who reverence language, who treat it as a gift and not as a weapon. And that's why I'm bringing the poets into this. But let me just explain a little bit more about why I think they must take stage at the moment. As I said, we have this graffiti and tweeting governance at the moment, excited talk of fake news, hoping will distract us from fake politicians, populist slogans, generalisations that are smoothing over. And as I said yesterday to some of you, you know, what's going on quite often is honest complexity about things is being reduced to dishonest simplicity about things. That's a very dangerous state of affairs if you just make everything dishonestly simple. And of course, poets do not shy away from difficulty, but we'll come back to that. But here we are in this world with this noise of now going on, and it leads to confusion in society about what it is we actually do believe, what we do want, what we think is possible. We have this consumerism that makes words seductive. We have technology that's giving a lot, or too many, of the words all over the place. And we're living in, as George Steiner argues, in an aftermath of a broken covenant, almost, between word and world. And for preachers, as I was saying yesterday, this is very serious, because the ears that everybody is using to listen to politicians and salespeople and news commentators are also listening to them, people of faith, and with the same distrust or confusion. So there's a lot of cynical use of language around at the moment, and it's been called truth decay. And in this arena, you wonder at the moment, don't you, whether society is just losing interest in truth, whether the idea of there even being objective truth, facts, is just now not so important to us than opinions, crisis chatter, infotainment. Is it just to be more interesting now to be interesting rather than right? Is there a declining value of accuracy? Is not what matters veracity or impact? And I think we're seeing this at the moment very much, aren't we? This leads to dishonesty, therefore not being held to account as it used to be. And lying, well, it can just be a laugh that is amusing people because it's messing up a system of value that you don't really like. Now, it is tempting to blame political and state leaders if this is our situation. Some seem to think that what is truthful is just what reinforces the mood of the crowd. There's a lot of changing honest complexity, as I said, into dishonest simplicity. And history, thankfully, is peppered with those who warn us about that sort of manipulation. And I mentioned as an example yesterday, Alexander Hamilton, who was one of course, America's founding fathers, now got a musical named after him. He argued in the 18th century for a system of constitutional checks and balances to guard against the possibility, and I'm now going to quote him. Remember how long ago this was written, and just hear the resonances fly into the present world. He said we need these constitutional checks and balances to guard against the possibility of a man unprincipled in private life and bold in his temper one day arising who might mount the hobby horse of popularity and flatter and fall in with all the nonsense of the zealots of the day in order to embarrass the government and throw things into confusion so that he can ride the storm and direct the whirlwind. Wow. Could you ever imagine it? Could it ever really be? I think this is perhaps why in the myth of America, it's always important that the first president was said to have said, "I cannot tell a lie." Whew, a long way from that at the moment. Now, as you know, people like George Orwell, Hannah Arendt, warned from experience that totalitarian rule ultimately takes hold by slow injections of falsity that people then begin to repeat. And so for all practical purposes, Orwell concluded, the lie will have become truth. And it spreads, and so you get a distrust, say, of experts. You get the belief that if science is inconvenient, well, it's a conspiracy. In history, historical studies, if it's not backing up your arguments, well, just revise it. Journalism can seemingly hold things at an objective distance, but actually is often self-reflecting. And religion, too, can hide a lot of darker truths with this religio speak and deference to authority and everybody being encouraged to say amen and not question the leaders. If there is anything to what I'm saying, if you are recognizing any of this, this is a very dangerous place to be. In John's Gospel, Pilate asks Jesus, what is truth? And of course he doesn't hang around to find out the answer, because the crowd are outside and he's scared. So he doesn't stick around to find out any answer to that question. However, for me, Christian communities and other religious communities do ask the same question, what is truth? And then they make a promise, we're going to stick around together, to pursue this question in relationship and worship. And I like to think that the church at its best is an antidote to any fashion of falsity, or they are people committing themselves to a pursuit of truth in dialogue, in fellowship, ready to be corrected when necessary. Now, we know history does not always bear this out, but it's an aspiration, and at the moment, a serious aspiration, it seems to me. A community of faith at the moment must be as unafraid to reason as it should be as unashamed to adore. And one of the roles of a church is to remind us that truth has other forms than facts, that sometimes truth is far too important to be literalistic about. And of course, again, this is something that the poets know, and in fact you know. So if you've ever been in love, and I'm guessing one or two of you have been, you know that the last thing you stop being is a literalist. You start to try and express your feelings, and you stretch your words, you push the boundaries, and when you look back in 20 years' time, you'll squirm with embarrassment at what you were trying to do. But you don't become literalistic, you become poetic. You use every image you can. And of course, this is the language, therefore, of love. And if it is the language of love, it must be the language of the church, the language of theology. I actually believe at the end of the day that you cannot be a theologian unless you are a student of love, because that's at the end of the day what it's about. So the language of love, mind you, I did once say to people, I was talking about this once, I said, many of you might have been in love. I can see a few blushed faces as I talk now. And I pointed at one woman and she said, oh no, it's just my time of life. Slightly skewed my whole argument, but we do know this, that actually being literalistic about truth is not always necessarily the final word. We need more. We need to explore truth in arts. So quite often when you see or you hear something in the artistic world, you can often say, I don't understand it, but you can also sense that somehow it understands you. Narratives, myths, these are the truths that are always within the inner landscape of the human. And, of course, I do think that people of faith celebrate this in their churches and in their worship, because poetry is in motion as soon as you go into any place of worship. And some people, as I was saying yesterday to some of you, that people come into a church with the wrong ears on. They come in listening for facts, and actually what they've done is they've walked into a poem. And that leads to a lot of frustration. But poetry within in a place like this has a density of suggestion. You are eavesdropping on the human soul, on a sensitive state of consciousness that poetry can prompt. So all those things are in play in a liturgy. So people of faith actually know this. This is their native language. It shouldn't be locked in here. It should be going out there too, is what I'm saying. And I'll just, in a moment, just talk a little bit more about how that might happen. So, poetry. Why are the poets important at the moment? Well, Wallace Stevens said that people ought to like poetry the way children like snow. I don't know what he meant by that, except for me, I get the sense that, yes, snow is thrilling, but it's icy, has an icy presence. It helps you reimagine your landscape. You remember that morning when you pull back the curtains and you think you know what you're going to look at, and snow has completely changed it? Poetry helps you reimagine your landscapes. And it also helps you see your own breath, the fragile gift of who you are in this landscape. So, yes, enjoy poetry the way children enjoy snow. And the thing about poetry, I think, in terms of the present climate is that one of the great joys of poetry is that it takes difficulty seriously. It doesn't try to avoid it. And all people of faith know that difficulty spiritually is very important. It's not something that you run away from. It's something that you're invited into. And again, if I ask people here, you know, tell me, what's been the most important part of your life? What's been the most transforming moment? Most people will point you to a difficult time. And it's the same in the spiritual life. And it must be the same in community life. We need to be honest about difficulties and not just pretend they're not there. So the difficulty of poetry is speaking truth. This is language, but not as we know it. And often people will say to me when I give them a poem, but I don't know what it means. Tell me what it means. And I say, well, if I'd played you a piece of music, you would think that was a silly question. Tell me what it means. The meaning is in your response to it. So Geoffrey Hill called it the democracy of poetry. Everybody's got a response to it. Everybody's got a voice to it. There's no one meaning. It means what you basically respond to it with. But you trust it as an art in the same way that you might believe in your doctor. You trust it. And in a Google-esque world, where knowledge is thought to be the same thing as information, where we're living in a world that is trying to seduce us with quick clarity, restless for easy headlines, the poets remind you that is not good enough. You need space around your words. You need to etch. Do you remember any of you having cards where actually the frost used to come on the inside of the window, so cold, or the bedroom sometimes, you had this, and you used to write your name in it. Imagine the poet being like that. Here's this icy, cold world. Here's this window, or maybe a piece of white paper, and you slowly begin to etch into it the words that matter, the words that resonate, that are near to the human in you. You have to be slow, you have to be careful, you have to space them well. You have to sometimes make them difficult because what they're giving voice to is. You know, Geoffrey Hill always used to say, my poetry is difficult because life is. Etch away slowly. And so in religion, I'm always very suspicious of, you know, easy, quick bumper sticker theology. You know. My friend Padraig O'Toole says, whatever the atonement means, you shouldn't be able to put it on a fridge magnet. I mentioned Padraig, who's a wonderful Irish Catholic thinker and poet, and here's one of his poems called The Facts of Life. The facts of life. That you were born and you will die. That you will sometimes love enough and sometimes not. That you will lie, if only to yourself. That you will get tired. That you will learn most from the situations you did not choose. that there will be some things that move you more than you can say. That you will live, that you must be loved. That you will avoid questions most urgently in need of your attention. That you began as the fusion of a sperm and an egg of two people who once were strangers and may well still be. That life isn't fair. That life is sometimes good and sometimes better than good. That life is often not so good. That life is real. And if you can survive it well, survive it well. With love and art and meaning, given where meaning's scarce. That you will learn to live with regret. That you will learn to live with respect. That the structures that constrict you may not be permanently constraining. That you will probably be okay. That you must accept change before you die. But you will die anyway. So you might as well live. And you might as well love. You might as well love. You might as well love. It's not an easy time for words. There are, as I say, so many of them not being reverenced and they're being cynically employed. And they talk very slippery sometimes, but I note sometimes now how politicians will easily talk about individuals rather than people. You get, of course, lots of talk at the moment about losers, swarms, sad failures of people. And this is making a world where we just see one another, therefore, as competitors, not citizens, consumers, not communities. And as somebody once said, it's leading to a world in which, if you're not at the table, you're probably on the menu. And nations, at the end of the day, are largely the stories they feed themselves. And if fed lies, they will, in time, suffer the consequences. If words are used cynically, cheaply, and as ammunition, if they're not respected, then, as I say, human beings won't be either. So, poets are needed to remind us that what we ultimately need is not a language about information, but about formation. Concerned as much with what it turns us into, as much as about what we know. We need a language that exposes our illusions but doesn't leave us disillusioned. We need a language that places space and silence around things, about words, so that you learn through the disclosure and the dislocation of these words. The great thing about poetry for me is that it distrusts first impressions. That's a really important thing. Jane Austen, by the way, she wrote Pride and Prejudice, as you know. She was going to first call it, before she gave it that title, First Impressions. Interesting, because, of course, first impressions do involve your pride and your prejudice about everything. And so your first impression of something or somebody is often just very distorted, a sort of fairground mirror version of somebody, playing a lot of your own projections. So the poet has to see beyond the first impression. And I'm afraid at the moment, so much of our political debates and our community conversations is about people's first impressions of everything. So where can it be distilled? Where can the familiar become strange again? More full of invitation and even intrigue. Well, from people who know how to use language well, who can help excavate the world better than just relying on first impressions of it. So although poetry and the poetic and those people who will shape words that are strange, although that can be difficult, as I say, language, but not as we know it, these are the crafters of a language that can actually transform people and perceptions and impressions, and therefore they are vital to any community. Not too long ago, I was asked to give a talk at a hospice in Taunton. And I decided, because she had not long died, to introduce to them some of the poems of Helen Dunmore. Some of you will know her novels. She was a great poet. And she died, as many of you will know, quite recently, and she spent her last months writing poems that were published after her death. And it's called Inside the Wave. Beautiful play on words, of course. She's inside the wave, but of course, as she's dying, she's waving goodbye. She's inside that wave as well. Several years ago, Helen Dunmore said that she was trying to do without scaffolding in her poetry. And the poems that she writes are alert, they're very generous, they're contained, and their resonance is born in this distillation that is, and this is the importance of what I'm saying here, consciously mortal, intuitively fascinating about the world that she's found herself in. And here, for example, is a poem that she wrote in her bed in the hospice. My life's stem was cut, it's called. My life's stem was cut, but quickly, lovingly, I was lifted up. I heard the rush of the tap, and I was set in water, in the blue vase, beautiful in lip and curve. And here I am, opening one petal as the tea cools. I wait while the sun moves and the bees finish their dancing. I know I am dying, but why not keep flowering as long as I can from my cut stem? Poems like that remind us of our inner landscape. We can play truant from the prosaic and attend to life's depths better. We can do it, but at the moment, my, we are going to need help. And poets and word crafters who are trying to form us as well as inform us promise in a poem more of you at the end than at the beginning. I love that idea. Look, I read that poem, and before I started, you were a different person to the person now that I've read it to you. Something's going on. I called my book The Splash of Words because I think when you've read a poem, there is that splash, that pebble in the pool. And when I finished that poem, you were very silent. I don't know if you sensed that. You went very quiet. That's the splash of words. And then the ripples are heading out towards your shore. And you might even still be thinking about that as you turn the light off later tonight. It will still be with you somewhere. Those are the ripples. And that's the wonderfulness of words properly employed for the human soul. And R.S. Thomas, a great Welsh priest and poet, said that a good poem will arrive in your intellect by way of your heart. So it's going there, but before it gets there, it's channeling here. And that's why I called the sermons by way of the heart. Although, as I said to somebody, I think they're more just a general help for any sleeping disorders. Once you read 50 of my sermons, to be honest, but there we are. So, number one, in this world of cynical use of language, the shallows that shallow language leave us in. We need to reverence language again, its pursuit of truth, both within and without. And we are going to need to utilize and be imaginative with our language. If we are people of faith, we need to do it in our preaching, in our worship, in our whatever we're writing. Don't be boring. Don't be prosaic. And all of us, in all our different work environments, in our communities, wherever we are operating, attend to language properly. And if there is cheap, cynical use going on, if somebody is suddenly saying a very easy, knowing little phrase, and you think, dissect it. Why are they saying that? Why does that feel wrong? I've noted in the paper today that apparently a lot of MPs are now being told to call the Surrender Act. And you have to keep calling it now the Surrender Act, as if it is about surrendering in a war. This is a wartime scenario that's being set up. Little moves like that all the time, and I just pick out that one because it's so obvious, but all the time we're all doing it. But don't go native to sloppy language. Words become flesh. Bring on the poets. But the second word that I've used is prophets. And this is perhaps a less easy thing to talk about, because people, again, have very weird understandings of what a prophet might be. We get sort of instant pictures, don't we, of sort of John the Baptist figures of unshaved heads and weird clothing and so on. And we often talk about us being prophets when we're annoyed about something. So I'm going to say it, you know. I'm just going to say it and they can sort it out. I'm right about something. That's my prophecy. And of course there is indeed in the history of faith people who are termed prophets who are rather condemning, because what they do, a good prophet, and we need them now, which is what I'm arguing, is a prophet looks ahead into the future, not like Mystic Meg, or as Ken Dodd used to say, I know I'm a medium because it says so in my knickers. We don't need those sort of mediums, or we don't need that. We need people who can see into the future as to what it's going to be like if we continue behaving as we are. And then the prophet reports back and says, you know, I think we might make a few amendments. You need to make some amendments. Now, that means that sometimes the prophets have to get heard, and what they do is they, you know, they get pretty strong, and actually they get rather poetic. A good prophet will often be very poetic in what they say, and you only need to think of people like Martin Luther King, whose prophecy about community living and so on was deeply poetic. And as I said yesterday, he never once said, I have a nightmare. He said, I have a dream. And his language was drawing you into the dream. But sometimes we can think that just because we're angry, we've become a prophet. But actually, the condemnation is not the prophet's heartland. If you're a prophet, you're not out to condemn. You're out ultimately to restore. You are trying to bring people home to themselves, to their senses. In the religious tradition, to their God. You're trying to restore the relationship to God and the world. You're not out to condemn. So what we mean by prophets needs to be refigured there, it seems to me. But certainly at the moment, we are going to need people like that. People who are fearless in actually telling us, if we don't stop this behaviour, this is where we're going to end up. And it's very costly for these people. It's a very unpleasant place to be quite often. But my goodness me, we're going to need them. And I do think it's one role, and of course, you know, so many people have a view on what the role of religion and the role of the church is in present society and so on. And quite often, in my own church, you end up with a sort of, you know, the bland leading the bland, and there's no real grit. Well, now, let me tell you, if the church has not got something strong to say about the times we're living in, it has nodded off. It has fallen asleep spiritually, because so much of the currents that are in our air at the moment are diametrically opposed to the vision of the gospel of Jesus Christ. There's no doubt about that. And if the church cannot say this, and to find a way of saying it that sounds plausible and attractive and doesn't just reflect the poisonous, toxic language that's being used in other places, if it's going to condemn it, it must not reflect it. So that's why the language is so important. But really, this is the time for the church to get its act together, it seems to me, to tell the world where it's leading if we just continue as we are. And this also leads to the other word that I've put in my title, protest. It seems to me that, there's going to have to be a lot of protest about what is becoming the status quo. And speak to a few Americans and they'll tell you how that feels at the moment. But to protest, again, what do I mean? Do I mean, just go into a sign up to go on a protest in London and march on 10 Downing Street? Well, maybe, yes, I do. But what I'm really talking about is, and I'm just trying to find my definition here of the protests that I wanted to speak about particularly. What I'm really talking about is when you realise that actually people are forgetting to have an imagination that allows them to see what it might be like to be somebody else rather than themselves. I do believe at the end of the day, Christian spirituality is the business of standing up for other people. I believe that because if you read the Gospels, that's sort of what Jesus Christ did. And if you're going to have a Christian spirituality, a spiritual life that is in his name, it seems to me that you are in the business of standing up for other people. And particularly the people that are being looked down on or scapegoated on. So, protesting is not just about getting on the bus and going down to Trafalgar Square, although it may well be. But it is also about seeing where the minority, the overlooked, the scapegoat, where people are talking as if there are first-class citizens and second-class citizens and third-class citizens. Where you see that, you protest and you say, don't you dare. Don't you dare do that. Because if you believe in God, and I'm taking some of you do here, if you do believe in God, you believe that God is the God of all those people. And that part of your Christian vocation is to make sure that nobody is overlooked. And that all are being encouraged to flourish. And where it's not happening, then you will need to protest. And how you do that, well, you know, answers please on a postcard, but there are lots of different ways of doing it. But some of it's going to have to be pretty courageous, it seems to me. It's going to hurt. And people will tell Christians and people of other faiths, you know, but religion should keep out of politics. Please, you know, just don't get involved. We'll do that. And they'll tell you that religion should be sort of private and personal, and pious. But then, I look at the cross of a man being publicly executed. That was not private and personal and pious. That was public and cruel and political. They killed him. They did not kill him because he was nice. They killed him because his preaching was unwelcome. His perceptions were dismantling the empire or what it was built on and on religious traditions. And as you know, quite often, tradition can be just peer pressure from the dead. And Jesus wouldn't have it, particularly when people became secondary to it. He protested. And he protested in such a way that started to annoy people, and more than annoy them. It meant nailing him to pieces of wood. There's nothing private or personal or pious about that. If we're following him, I think we better start protesting a bit. Erich Fried was an Austrian writer, poet. He wrote in German, and one poem that he ends with, ended his life, well, yes, he wrote it towards the end of his life, was in German, but I'm going to read it in English. And I want to end this talk with it. Because you could sit here tonight and say, oh, dear Franklin, I don't think I've got the energy. I'll just have a jammy dodger and a cup of tea and say my prayers. But of course, the real prayer that we all have is to become the answer to our prayers. That's our ultimate aim, is to become what we pray for. But it is daunting. It's quite a vocation that the Christian or the person of faith is signed up to. It's serious stuff. And I'm saying at the moment, we're going to find out it's serious. Because we need to be true to it. We need to stand for something and not fall for anything. And Erich Fried wrote this. And I find myself encouraged by it when I get a bit despondent. And I often think of Martin Luther King, actually, how he could easily have said, I have a nightmare, and never did. But here's Erich Fried. It is nonsense, says reason. It is what it is, says love. It's unhappiness, says reflection. It's nothing but pain, says fear. It's hopeless, says insight. It is what it is, says love. It's ridiculous, says pride. It's frivolous, says caution. It's impossible, says experience. It is what it is, says love. I read that, and I always remember the other Martin Luther, who said, even if I knew the world was going to end tomorrow, I would still plant my little apple tree. There's a lot of planting to be done. Become a poet, become a prophet, become a protester. Our work is before us. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the Leeds Church Institute. If you'd like to know more about the Leeds Church Institute, visit lcileeds.org.